the primary conservation arguments against it, I actually don't necessarily subscribe to, but I am concerned about what I would call the hubris of the main actors involved behind this, and in terms of their kind of glib willingness to kind of discount the challenges of reintroducing an extinct species that all of us who work regularly in conservation, right? This is our day-to-day. How do we sustain small populations? How do we get them to thrive in the wild? How do we manage a low amount of genetic diversity? How do we deal with, you know, other stressors in the environment? Like, this is all everyday conservation, and those folks are not talking about it at all.
Welcome to the Case for Conservation podcast, where we explore biodiversity conservation and the environment more broadly and interrogate conventional wisdom for the sake of a more robust case for conservation. I'm your host, Andre Marder. As a result of our success as a species, we've been ushering other species toward extinction for thousands of years. The pace of those extinctions increased markedly with the growth of the world's population since the Industrial Revolution, but we are now within reach of the Jurassic Park-type fantasy of being able to reverse extinctions, to bring back species from the dead. On the other hand, assuming we get beyond the remaining technological obstacles, de-extinction is still a very complex topic, with conservation and ecological considerations that are not necessarily being considered by those who are most likely to make de-extinction happen. Virginia Matzek is a restoration ecologist and professor at Santa Clara University who navigates us through this convoluted subject. The first part of the discussion is an explanation of how de-extinction works. After that, we get into the various arguments for and against de-extinction. Virginia is remarkably even-handed in her treatment of both sides of the argument, and some of her reasons might not be what one would expect. I began by asking her to define de-extinction, on the assumption that there may be differing views out there.
I do think that it's something that maybe has a variable definition depending on how far you think you have to go to say that you've de-extincted a species. So technically, it's bringing back something back to Earth, something that has gone extinct, kind of a Jurassic Park thing, right? Actually, when I teach about this with my students, I always ask them if what species they would want to be brought back from the dead. There is a surprising amount of enthusiasm for dinosaurs. And I'm like, did you guys not see the movie? Like, that did not end well. But always megafauna, you know, it's always like the really, you know, nobody wants to bring back an extinct fern or a beetle, you know. So I would say probably we're also talking about animal species. I totally could imagine that researchers might be able to find seeds or herbarium samples or something from an extinct species and get it to germinate. And the answer, like the reaction to that would be totally ho-hum. Like nobody would care at all or even think of that as de-extinction, because what we have in mind is a sort of biotech miracle of an animal that has, you know, been wiped off of the earth coming back and living again. And then the how far do you go question is, you know, have you de-extincted a species if you've brought back just one individual? Because by that standard, we've actually already done it. So there has been one species brought back, the Pyrenean ibex or Bucardo. I can talk more about that, but it wasn't a huge success. But I would say that's not enough for me. Like, if we're going to say we've de-extincted a species, then it ought to meet more of a definition of having like a thriving, self-sustaining population in the wild that, you know, roams its native territory without intervention. And what's influencing my thinking there is the U.S. Endangered Species Act. So when the Endangered Species Act was passed in the U.S., the standard was not that any individual of the species still was extant. A species doesn't come off the list because there's a few individuals in zoos. You needed to have self-sustaining populations that could survive without intervention in their critical habitat. And so that's, I think, the right definition for when we could say, oh, yes, we've successfully de-extincted that species, is that it would be the kind of thing that could be taken off of the U.S. Endangered Species Act.
All right. Would you mind actually just going into a bit of detail about that Pyrenean ibex? And my pronunciation is different to yours, but...
Well, it's just called the Bucardo, because that's probably...
What's the story behind that?
So this is a mountain goat, an ibex, and it was a subspecies of various, so there are many European subspecies of mountain goats, and the Pyrenean species had one remaining individual. It went, you know, it declined like many of the European relatives of that species from a combination of hunting, habitat loss, and disease when the populations got small. So the diseases were transmitted by cattle and other livestock. So it got down to one individual. Her name was Celia, and she was living in captivity. She was actually killed in a freak accident by a falling tree branch. Poor creature. But before she died, they had cryopreserved some of her skin tissue from her ear in a, you know, a flask of liquid nitrogen or something. And so they used the main cloning technique that we're going to talk about as the way that de-extinction will probably happen to bring back an embryo of a Bucardo and implant it in a goat as a surrogate mother, and it was born. So that was the first de-extinction, if that's your standard of bringing back a single individual. So the Bucardo was the first species to come back from extinction. That animal lived 7 minutes. And so the Bucardo also has the very unfortunate distinction of being the only species to go extinct twice. It died of some kind of congenital deformities that may be a, you know, reason to doubt the near-term success of de-extinction, even though it was using a process that we're pretty familiar with, the same cloning process that produced Dolly the sheep and other animal clones. And that embryo was one of, you know, maybe several hundred that were attempted that did not make it. So it's not a very high success proposition. And in fact, the team that worked on the Bucardo, I don't think is still making much effort in that area.
So how long ago was that? Because my next question was actually, where are we technologically in terms of making de-extinction possible? So have we advanced since then?
Definitely. Definitely we've advanced since then. And I would have to look up the date for you. I want to say it's in the last 10 years that or maybe in the early 2000s that the Bucardo effort was going on. So there are several major candidates to be the first truly de-extincted species. The mammoth, woolly mammoth, a species called the thylacine, which is also known as the Tasmanian tiger, the Tasmanian wolf, and the passenger pigeon, which is, you know, known to North Americans, kind of our, like, the conservation story that is so puzzling, because how did something go extinct when what it was mainly known for was being incredibly numerous? So there are, you know, major efforts to revive all three of those species. I would say the Bucardo effort seems to be a bit stalled. The passenger pigeon people are also maybe working on the heath hen. But the major organizations working in the space are two. One is called Colossal Biosciences. This is kind of the organization founded by George Church from Harvard. And it's taking on the mammoth and the thylacine. The other one is called Revive and Restore, which is an outgrowth of Stuart Brand's kind of visions. So if you don't know Stuart Brand, that's Whole Earth Catalog and The Well and the Long Now Foundation and a whole bunch of other professional visionary, right? So Revive and Restore is working on the passenger pigeon, and they pass the mammoth off to Colossal and maybe the thylacine too. But anyway, they're the major organizations. And the technology at this point is basically at the stage of trying to figure out how you go from a sequenced genome to an actual embryo. And, you know, like if you think back to Jurassic Park, a lot of what they describe in that is about the challenge of getting the ancient DNA, the dinosaur DNA. Famously, it's, you know, mosquitoes supposedly found the dinosaurs and they got fossilized in amber. They glossed over the part where you turn it into an actual animal. The way I tell my students about it is that DNA is a blueprint. The architect doesn't come to you with the blueprints and say, like, oh, you can move into your house now, right? You need planks and, you know, windows and shingles and all that thing. And so getting from, you know, genetic information, a sequenced genome, even an ancient one, to an actual animal is, that's a tricky bit. But it's not the only tricky bit. That's sort of what I was saying earlier about the neglected aspect of the story, is that there's also figuring out whether that embryo can be gestated or hatched in a living species that might be a species of conservation interest now, and then rearing and, you know, growing up enough of a population to be reintroduced. And those challenges, which are you know, quite a bit down the road, are nonetheless the ones that we, I think, ought to be thinking about now before we get too far with the biotech.
Just a quick question, and this is not really that important to the discussion, but just, you know, for those who whose knowledge of de-extinction is limited to Jurassic Park, as far as I understand, like, the first obstacle is having viable DNA, right? And in the case of dinosaurs, that's not really possible, very unlikely to be possible, because DNA degrades over time. So that was, there's just too much time has passed. And also, we don't have organic matter, dinosaur organic matter. It's fossils are not organic, right? So that's kind of the first obstacle. And that's the reason why there is sort of, you know, at least some possibility of bringing back species like mammoths, where we have actual organic samples, versus dinosaurs, where we don't.
Yeah, you're right about both of those things. That those are the, that's why we're not getting back the dinosaurs. So we're not getting back the dinosaurs because DNA just gets too degraded over that period of time. You know, the half-life of DNA is in the neighborhood of, you know, several thousand years. And so half of it is degraded in a short period of time. And probably there's no usable DNA more than a million years old. There were, you know, when Michael Crichton wrote Jurassic Park, he was basing it off of papers that purported to have found viable DNA from extremely old, millions and millions of year old samples. That work was done in good faith with the, you know, techniques available at the time, but it was all hopelessly contaminated by modern DNA. And so the researchers who did that work and concluded that they had found, say, you know, beetles in amber, you know, from the Miocene or whatever, did not know that they were actually contaminating their samples with modern beetle DNA or whatever. So we're not getting the dinosaurs back. It's too degraded. And even, you know, so finding samples with DNA that's ancient, the mammoth effort is the oldest of the species, right? The longest ago extinction of the ones that we're talking about. And a lot of that DNA is coming out of bones from Pleistocene era sediment deposits in the Yukon. So they're doing gold mining, hydraulic mining up in the Yukon. And as they dissolve these hillsides, bone shards come out of it. And people like Beth Shapiro from UC Santa Cruz go and pick them up and get the ancient DNA out of them. And so the mammoth genome is now sequenced from those kinds of samples. So yeah, ancient DNA has been the problem.
Right. And as you say, there's a big step to go from the sequence to the actual creation of the species, and you need this surrogate species, right? So in the case of a mammoth as well, they were talking about using an Asian elephant because that's the closest living relative to a mammoth. So pardon the stupid question, but why not, you know, if some species can be kind of grown in test tubes, then why do you need a mother, an actual living mother to make it happen? I mean, could it be done in potentially in a lab with future technology?
Well, I mean, a lot of this is actually the same kind of technology we use for in vitro fertilization for people, in the sense that you can do the fertilization, or you can create, you know, your starting embryo in the lab. But ultimately, it has to be, we think, so far, right? Even in people, it has to be gestated in an actual person.
Right.
So if you want, let's talk a little bit about cloning and how that will and won't work for extinct species. If you remember Dolly was the sheep that was the first major kind of animal clone. That process is called somatic cell nuclear transfer. And somatic cell nuclear transfer will figure into de-extinction of the mammoth, the thylacine, not probably the passenger pigeon, but basically, and this is how the Bucardo was cloned. So remember that they had living cells from Celia, the last Bucardo. So what you do in somatic cell nuclear transfer is you have a donor animal that is of a closely related or the same species, right? So in Dolly's case, it was a sheep. In the Bucardo's case, it was a domestic goat. That animal gives an egg, an ovum. And then you slurp out its nucleus, because that's where the DNA is, right? So you enucleate it, you take out the DNA, and then you can take any old cell, a somatic cell of any kind, it can be skin, you know, whatever, from the animal that you want to clone, and you slurp out its nucleus, and then you put that nucleus into the donor egg cell that's now empty. So what you have is an egg cell that is now diploid. It contains all of the genetic information for a new animal, and it contains the genetic information of the thing you want to clone. And the real breakthrough actually was not popping nuclei in and out of cells. It was stimulating that cell that's been messed with to actually divide as an embryo and to develop into an embryo. And so once they solved that problem, it was a matter of just using, you know, what we know from downstream of IVF in people of, you know, implanting the embryo into a uterus and gestating it and having Dolly be born. So just to recap, right, what you need is you need a close living relative to be the donor egg and also surrogate mom. And then you need living tissue from the thing that you're going to clone so that you can take its nucleus out and pop it into that donor egg. Okay. So the Bucardo could be cloned that way because they had the cryopreserved, you know, they still had living skin tissue from Celia, the last Bucardo. So they could do it that way. The problem with everything else is there is no living tissue left. You can extract DNA from, you know, these ancient samples, or you might have, you know, taxidermied or, you know, formalin preserved samples of the thylacine, but there's nothing alive. So in addition to the, you know, problem of sequencing the genome, if the DNA has degraded, it's also that you just don't have that nucleus for this somatic cell nuclear transfer process anymore. So the solution to that will be CRISPR.
Which means editing an a different genome.
To recap what CRISPR is, right? CRISPR is probably the biggest biological breakthrough of the last, I don't know, 50 years, 100 years, lots of years. You know, it has become a generic genome editing tool. It's originally a tool that bacteria use to fight off viruses. When they are attacked by a virus, they're able to recognize viral DNA and snip a little bit of out of it and put it in their own DNA. And then when they're attacked again, they use that to kind of identify the part of the viral genome that they want to deactivate. So this is a kind of snip out the DNA and replace tool. And what Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier won the Nobel Prize for was turning it into a tool that could be used basically on any genome to take any bit of DNA from here and swap it into a genome there. So the idea is that you still need a close living relative, right? So as you mentioned, for the mammoth, it would be the Asian elephant. But what you do is you would take the Asian elephant egg, and instead of taking its nucleus out and swapping it in, you would edit it, right? You'd use CRISPR to you compare the two sequence genomes, and every place there was a difference between Asian elephant and woolly mammoth genes, you would conclude that that was some thing that needed to be, you know, edited into the Asian elephant genome. So it might code for the woolly coat, or it might code for the longer tusk, or the cold tolerance, or, you know, whatever it is. Probably a lot of that DNA will code for nothing, right? A lot of it will be junk, or it'll be repetition. But so, you know, comparing the two sequence genomes, we already have them. And the technique is kind of cut and paste, right? Because CRISPR already exists. It is so accessible a technique that students at my university do it. You know, it's not that difficult to do. The problem is that one of the problems, and the reason we don't have an edited Asian elephant egg to start, you know, turning into an embryo and putting into an Asian elephant to grow a woolly mammoth right now, is that although Asian elephants and woolly mammoths are very, very closely related, 99.9% genetic similarity, there's still 3 billion base pairs in an Asian elephant genome. So even that 0.1% different is still like, I don't know, like a million edits, right? That's probably not the right number, but it's a giant number of edits to make. And so if you don't make them all, have you really got a woolly mammoth? What you definitely have is an edited Asian elephant, but have you edited all the right things in? Have you done enough editing? I mean, that's sort of an unknown right now as to whether whether the DNA is actually robust enough to accommodate so many edits. Like, I think the record for the number of CRISPR edits that have been able to, you know, be made on the same strand is in, I want to say, in the tens and not in the millions of edit. So it sounds like technology is ready and the sequence genome is ready, but it's still a pretty challenging thing to do enough editing to go from an Asian elephant to a woolly mammoth. So, but imagine, so we're back at the cell now, right? We have an edited egg, and maybe we can make that be an embryo. Then we have to gestate it if we're talking about mammals. And so the Asian elephant would be the surrogate mom. And that's good because Asian elephants and woolly mammoths are at least roughly the same size. We don't know what the gestation period was for mammoths. Hopefully, if they were inside of an Asian elephant, they would, you know, cook for long enough to actually develop and be born at the right time. It's a little trickier when we start talking about the thylacine. So the thylacine, this Tasmanian tiger, is a marsupial animal. It's sort of dog-like, you know, maybe the size of a coyote or a medium-sized dog. Its closest living relative is an animal called the dunart, which is the size of a mouse. So that seems impossible at the outset until you remember that it's a marsupial. So in marsupials, the fetus climbs out of the uterus and into the pouch when it's very, very tiny, maybe as small as a grain of rice. So potentially, the dunart could still be used to gestate the thylacine embryo up to the point where the fetus crawls out into the pouch. And then there would have to be some kind of artificial womb or some, this is maybe getting back to what you're talking about, do we actually need to gestate in a surrogate mom or could we use something in the lab? Whatever that lab thing is for a marsupial, it has not been developed, but it's kind of considered to be one of the breakthroughs that would have to happen for the thylacine to be de-extincted. And then it's a totally separate problem with birds, right? Because birds are, you know, their embryos are partly produced internally and then also grow and hatch outside of the body. So one possibility that I've read about is to use a breakthrough that they've actually already used for animal husbandry and poultry, which is that if you take the primordial germ cells of, let's say, a chicken, so the primordial germ cells are the ones that when the chicken grows up are going to be either sperm or eggs. If you can extract those from a chicken and inject them at just the right time of development into, say, a duck, some other bird. So you inject into the egg, into the duck embryo. When the duck grows up, it hatches, it grows up, it's still a duck. It makes duck sperm or duck eggs, but it also makes chicken sperm or chicken eggs. And if, so if you take this chimeric duck that is simultaneously producing its own sperm and chicken sperm, and you breed it with another duck, right, that's making chicken eggs and duck eggs, at least some of the offspring should be chickens. They've done this. Chickens have hatched from ducks. It's wild. So that's a possibility that you know, again, because you don't have the primordial germ cells from the extinct species, what you'd be doing is editing the primordial germ cells of your close relative with CRISPR and then injecting those into that same embryo and hoping that they produce sperm and eggs to breed and make actual passenger pigeons. There's also, I think the Revive and Restore team is also working on finding a way to engineer pigeons so that they actually express the CRISPR-Cas9 system in their own genes to make edits more possible within the embryo. I have to say that's a little bit beyond my biotech savvy, and I don't know very much more about it than that. So yeah, I mean, that's biotech-wise, that's sort of where we are, is stuck at the stage of here we have some DNA, and we know what the genome ought to look like, and we've got a close relative, but it's a big challenge to go to the actual animal.
Right. And presumably very expensive as well, right? Like this, at least with the current technology, this is a very lengthy and costly process.
Yeah. And mostly running off of private money, from what I understand.
So it sounds like, you know, there are huge technological challenges, but ones which, you know, considering how far we've come in the past, let's say 50 years, you know, not insurmountable challenges to actually making it happen, and potentially on a large scale as well, although that's a next step. But I guess that that brings us to the more sort of ecological and conservation oriented question of what are the cases for and against de-extinction. And my understanding is that you are at least slightly skeptical of you know, whether this is a good idea and whether it's something that would benefit conservation.
Yeah, I have to say the primary conservation arguments against it, I actually don't necessarily subscribe to, but I am concerned about what I would call the hubris of the main actors involved behind this in terms of their kind of glib willingness to kind of discount the challenges of reintroducing an extinct species that all of us who work regularly in conservation, right? This is our day-to-day. How do we sustain small populations? How do we get them to thrive in the wild? How do we manage a low amount of genetic diversity? How do we deal with, you know, other stressors in the environment? Like, this is all everyday conservation, and those folks are not talking about it at all. So, I would say, you know, I don't subscribe to the main argument that the proponents of de-extinction are throwing out, which is that bringing back these species is going to help an ecosystem function. And that's kind of, you know, you mentioned rewilding. I think rewilding is the term of art for when what you think is wrong with an ecosystem is that it's missing some species, probably an animal species that, you know, has a highly regulatory function in that. So if it's a top predator and, you know, now there's like a trophic cascade going on where everything's all screwed up because the top predator is missing. Those are the kinds of arguments they're using. So the thylacine, you know, it was for a time the apex predator of the Australian continent, and it became restricted to Tasmania. And, you know, one of the arguments is that we need to bring back the apex predator there. It would consume other non-native species like foxes and feral cats. And, you know, it would be a good regulator of ecosystem function there. With the mammoth, they're talking about it as an ecosystem engineer that needs to trample the steppe in order to make the snow layer thinner, which would actually make the soil temperature colder because there would be less of an insulating blanket of snow. And that would, you know, the colder temperatures in the peat of those lands would then retard carbon loss and you know, carbon emissions from soil decomposition and so on. So, you know, those are the kinds of arguments that are being thrown out. I think they're all overblown. I actually think they're basically, can I say bullshit on this podcast? if not, you can edit that out. But, you know, and I don't mean that if the mammoth or the thylacine were de-extincted, that those effects wouldn't be felt. But I mean, the thylacine, you know, it would act as a predator. But I don't believe for a minute that that's why the people behind these efforts are doing it. The passenger pigeon might actually just be a passion project. I don't know. But honestly, if what you wanted was better trampling of the snow, there's plenty of other cold-tolerant ungulates that you could introduce there to do it. In fact, that has been done at a place called Pleistocene Park in Russia, where the guy behind that has shown that the trampling helps, kind of. But he's using ungulates that are extant, right? We don't need mammoth to do it. I mean, maybe you could cheaper, easier, faster, and more immediately come out with some kind of machine that tramples the snow layer on the savannah. Like, I'm just totally not buying the idea that you actually have to go to all of the trouble of de-extincting a species that went extinct, you know, 8,000 years ago in order to preserve a little more carbon in peat in the Siberian steppe. So I think those arguments are all kind of garbage. I should say, I don't think that rewilding and the idea of restoring animals to restore important functions is itself garbage. And we have some examples of this in restoration ecology, like on the island of Mauritius, the giant land tortoises went extinct, and they used to be the main dispersers of ebony seeds. And when they went extinct, the ebony forests were kind of in decline. People brought giant tortoises from Aldabra, which are close relatives and kind of functionally similar, moved them onto Mauritius, and now they are occupying that function. I mean, rewilding for that purpose, it's a thing. I believe in it. But I just don't think that it's enough of an argument, you know, to go to all this trouble of bringing back de-extinct species. I would say the better argument for it is that the technologies are going to trickle down to other kinds of conservation and human health uses. I mean, figuring out how to make a marsupial artificial pouch could be good for marsupial conservation generally. It could be good in some way, maybe for, I don't know, human fertility. And I think the potential for genetic rescue of species that are low genetic diversity. This has actually already been shown to work, and it's directly related to these same technologies we've been talking about. So this is actually Revive and Restore's gig. Like, they are, de-extinction is only a small part of their portfolio, and a lot of what they're talking about is basically, how can we better use biotech in conservation? How can we get hidebound conservation scientists, and ecologists to not be so scared of biotechnology that they aren't willing to embrace some of the ways that it could be helpful? So as an example of how this kind of cloning technology has helped an extant species, there's the example of the black-footed ferret. The black-footed ferret in the western United States was a species that was thought to go extinct back in the 30s when ranchers had wiped out its main prey, the prairie dog, and then they found this one colony of black-footed ferrets on one ranch, the last individuals. They were all very closely related. So the species is coming back. You know, they're rearing them and they're reintroducing them elsewhere, but the fact that they are so lacking in genetic diversity is very worrisome for their long-term future. And they found in, I think, the San Diego Zoo's Frozen Zoo Biobank, cryopreserved tissue from black-footed ferrets that had died more than 40 years ago and were totally unrelated to that family group that was remaining. And so they've now used that tissue to clone a black-footed ferret as a breeding animal, right? As a way to inject much-needed genetic diversity into the population. So the first one, her name is Elizabeth Ann, she's a, you know, like, female black-footed ferret that is going to bring a lot of genetic diversity to that population. And so that's the kind of thing that, like, I can get behind. I really would love to see these technologies be useful for extant species. So those are the main fours. I would say, you know, what I hear about the against, you know, some people will say that, like, it's not a good idea to let biotech rescue a species because then it gives people carte blanche to, you know, destroy them. Meh. I've never subscribed to this thread of argument because I feel like we're doing a pretty good job of destroying species on our own without needing carte blanche from, you know, this particular example. I also feel like that same exact, you know, accusation could be leveled at restoration ecology as a field. Like, well, if you're going to go out there and, like, fix it, you know, what's the point? And, you know, we'll just, everybody will destroy everything. Nobody says we don't need more restoration ecology because it will be an excuse to destroy ecosystems. Like, or I have yet to hear anybody, you know, advancing that as a reasonable point of view. I suppose you would get the, you know, we can't play God people as part of that argument. Yeah, whatever. I mean, we are gods now. As a restoration ecologist, like, my field has been called glorified gardening, but really we're, you know, we're the people in charge of the planet now. We're totally in charge of the planet. What we save is what will get saved. What we destroy is what's going to be gone. You know, Stuart Brand actually has a great line about this. He says, if we're going to be gods, we might as well get good at it, right? So let's get good at it with biotech. I'm down with that. You know, practically speaking, a lot of it is not going to work, and it's not going to work at first. Like, the amount of trial and error, if you think about all of conservation, how much trial and error we've had to go through with everything, like learning how to save the condor or whatever, you know, that's time intensive, it's money intensive, there's lots of failures along the way. Sometimes we completely screw up and don't, you know, don't make it happen, and other times it's just very hard won information. So, you know, that will certainly be true of these efforts, but we never use that as a reason not to do it. Right? Maybe it's a moonshot, but we did a moonshot and it worked. So yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of discounting all of the against arguments I can think of. I get people sometimes say, oh, you know, we should be spending conservation dollars more wisely. Okay, but that's not how conservation dollars work. Like, they don't think they're fungible in that way, that if somebody is going to give to a cause, that they're not going to give to their local restoration project because they'd rather give money to George Church to resurrect the woolly mammoth. I don't think those are the same people. This has been found with ecosystem services too, that it actually expands the stream of income and people who are engaged by it rather than, you know, trading off in a zero sum game. So,
and also, I guess, you know, in any endeavor, there should be kind of a division of resources to continuing to do what we know works and also trying to find out new things, right? You can't do just the one or just the other. So, and I guess this rewilding and de-extinction fit very much into the the innovation.
I mean, I would love to have, you know, I would love to have, let's say, 1% of, you know, the annual budget of Colossal Biosciences for conservation. Like I could do a hell of a lot of good with that, right? Mm-hmm. I would love to have some of that for conservation. It would go farther, no doubt in my mind. But I don't think it's available. Like, I just don't think that the private money sources or soft money sources that are giving money to Colossal are interested in funding, you know, on the ground, you know, lions and tigers.
Mm-hmm. Would another potential point against de-extinction and rewilding, that sort of combination, would another point against be the issue that especially the longer ago something went extinct, the more kind of alien it's become from its own ecosystem. So even if you're introducing it to the same ecosystem, it still means that you're introducing something to a system which has changed and other species have appeared and disappeared. And you know, it could be akin to introducing a species, an alien species, which has a higher chance than usual of becoming invasive and becoming a problem.
Yeah. You know, I study invasion. I actually don't worry about invasion in this context all that much. It might be naive because I think if there's a reason to worry about it, it's that invasion ecology is full of all kinds of examples of well-meaning introductions where we thought we were going to be doing something of benefit and it ended up being a detriment. But the species that they're talking about bringing back don't fit the profile of the kind of species that have really run rampant as invaders. They're not, you know, weedy or ruderal or our selected species. And I also think that, you know, mostly what I think the harm of invasion is globally is homogenization, right? It's that we get a certain sameness of species everywhere because some species are wildly successful at, you know, all over the world. And often they decrease the populations of the more local or endemic species. But invasions are not implicated in very many extinctions. Most of the extinctions that have been due to invasion have been in introductions on islands, you know, so of endemic species that don't have populations elsewhere. And, you know, often predator animals, you know, predators of birds or of bird eggs. So, you know, I don't want to completely discount that as an argument. But I think that the reason that we're wary about it is that we just have this kind of general view of people with hubris have done bad things in the past and it's resulted in invasions. But these species, I don't know. I don't see them as being good candidates as invaders.
Just wanted to push back a little bit on the, and I also don't want to sidetrack us, but on the dangers of invasive species, generally speaking, and not to counter your point about the candidate species potentially being invasive, but invasive species in general, there's an IPBES report that came out recently, and one of the kind of headline key messages was that 60% of species extinctions have been associated with invasive species to some extent. So not necessarily entirely because of invasive species, but to some extent. So it's potentially, of the five main drivers of biodiversity loss, it is potentially the main cause of species lost. So invasive species are a big issue, but that's kind of a separate question as to whether a de-extinct species put back in its original ecosystem would be likely to be one or not. And you mentioned our selected species. So those are species which their sort of reproductive strategy is to produce large numbers of offspring that don't necessarily survive, so that some of them do survive rather than investing a lot in a small number of offspring. So I could see what you mean there. So with mammoths, for example, they'd be having one or two young at a time. But I'm also reminded that, and I'm a bit rusty on the history here, but in African elephant populations, there have been, under different circumstances, situations where circumstances or environments have changed. And there's been a population explosion of elephants, which has, because they're such ecosystem engineers, it has sort of had quite an impact on the environment. You know, and that's a pretty analogous example with mammoths, for example. So I don't know, I guess I would be more concerned about the potential for these species to kind of act like a new species in an ecosystem, which could wreak some havoc. But,
I think a point that you bring up is about how much the ecosystem has changed since the species went extinct.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the thylacine went extinct in the 1930s. The passenger pigeon And the last one is in the 1910s. So they're pretty recent species. And yet, you know, we've changed the environment quite a lot since then. I actually think that that question of, you know, I do think it matters a lot how long ago and for what reason the species went extinct. But I don't think of that so much in terms of invasion and more as whether it will be a success at reintroduction.
You mean that the reintroduced species is more likely to suffer than the species in the ecosystem?
Right, that the de-extincted species will find that it actually can't make a go of its new environment. And, you know, like there's a lot of conservation examples with extant species to, you know, to bring to bear this. A fundamental thing is that it doesn't make a lot of sense to reintroduce a species from a captive population if you haven't relieved the stressors in the environment that cause it to, you know, have to be withdrawn from the wild in the first place. So we found this out with the condor. They were eating deer carcasses that had lead bullets in them, and all of the, you know, birds had to be brought in and chelated every year to get rid of the lead poisoning, and they had to be taught with aversion therapy how not to land on power poles because they were getting electrocuted. And like the, you know, every single panda that gets reintroduced to the wild in China has to go to a training center where all of the people who work there dress up in panda costumes that are suffused with panda pee so that they won't get too attached to humans. Like this, there's a lot of effort in training species that have even spent a generation, but hopefully not multiple generations, in captive breeding, how to live in the wild and to make sure that whatever the stressors are relieved. I'm not sure that that's true for the mammoth or for the thylacine or for the passenger pigeon, honestly. So, you know, the mammoth went extinct when the ice sheets retreated. Probably human hunting was a factor in that extinction, but also it was just climate change. We're not going in a colder direction. You know, we're going to be having less and less habitat that is suitable for the mammoth, not more and more. And then the thylacine. So the thylacine was on mainland Australia, and then it became restricted to the island of Tasmania, probably because it was pushed out by the dingo. So the dingo is a relatively recent arrival to Australia, and the dingo probably outcompeted the thylacine. So I've been up and down the Colossal Biosciences website to see if they really are thinking about bringing the thylacine back to the mainland, and it seems like they are. What would be the point? I mean, I just don't understand when the dingo is present there, and when Australians want to kill the dingoes because of their predation on sheep, and they have a whole fence that goes across the entire continent to try to keep the dingoes out of Southeast Australia. It just boggles my mind that they can just sort of cavalierly say, we're going to reintroduce this apex predator that probably doesn't belong on the mainland anyway, because it's outcompeted by the dingo, and that people originally shot and deliberately exterminated because they thought it predated their livestock. I just, like, who's asking Australians, like, is this a good idea? Do you want the thylacine back? You know, where can we put it? Like, I don't know. Those are just, you know, some examples. Passenger pigeons, they flew over North America in flocks of millions of birds, right? They darkened the skies. They landed in forests and ate everything out of the forest, and then they pooped everywhere. Do you want a passenger pigeon back? I'm not sure we want the passenger pigeon back. Like, it's so these are the issues that I feel are not being addressed enough. And, you know, for the most part, for extinct species, we don't know anything about their behavior. So we know nothing about mammoth behavior. Everything we know about thylacine behavior, there's about 30 seconds of video from a zoo in Hobart, Tasmania, that has two or three thylacines in it. That's everything we know about their sociality. Some grainy video. So as an example, like, people have called that species the Tasmanian wolf, and they've called it the Tasmanian tiger because it's kind of stripy. Well, that's kind of instructive, because wolves and tigers are really different in terms of their behavior. I mean, the thylacine is neither, right? But just going off the common names, wolves are pack animals, and they have a whole complicated breeding structure where there's one pair bonded, male and female, and the juvenile males are kicked out, and the, you know, other females help to raise the young. That's wolves. Tigers are solitary. They don't have a lot of social, they meet to breed, that's it. So do we know about the thylacine? Is it more like a wolf or is it more like a tiger? When they reintroduced the wolf to Yellowstone, they were pretty careful to make sure that they had pack structure that would be able to breed. And it was a great success in the terms of the number, you know, sex and relatedness of the individuals that were in the pack. We don't know that about the thylacine. There are species of colony nesting birds like boobies. They don't breed when they first arrive at their breeding colony. They wait until there's enough of a critical mass of other birds to feel safety in numbers or whatever it is. But they don't breed right away. So how many passenger pigeons do you need to induce breeding behavior? Is one pair going to breed? You need 100 pairs? Like, nobody knows any of this stuff. And again, like I was on this panel for the National Academy of Sciences for the Life Sciences Board. They were kind of looking ahead to whether there were any issues that they needed to address. And so I was brought on to talk about the ecological and conservation aspects of reintroduction. And Beth Shapiro, who's also has an ecology background, but was mainly talking about the genetic side, was there. There was an ethicist, and then they had two people. They had somebody from Revive and Restore, and they had somebody from Colossal Biosciences. And they were making these statements like, well, if we bring back the thylacine, it will eat the foxes. And, you know, thylacines would have prevented the Tasmanian devil from getting facial tumor disease because they would have eaten out the sick and the young or the, you know, the old or whatever, and it would not have, you know, spread that disease. So, and I was amazed at the willingness to just throw out these conjectures about this animal that is actually extinct, that like almost no living people have ever seen, and just treat them as though they were fact. I was like, I didn't say this to her, but I was like, I almost wanted to say, like, I'm just begging you to read one thing about animal behavior before you just like throw out an idea. Yeah, thylacines will eat foxes when we bring them back. So I'm very concerned that people are not thinking about all of the issues. And there are more. I mean, there's ethical issues. There are regulatory issues. There's the stakeholder consultation that we have learned a long, hard lesson about in conservation, about making sure that before you take a conservation action, that you have some stakeholder buy-in. Nobody is doing any of that, right?
And as you said, much of the reasoning for bringing back these species seems to be suspiciously sort of retrofitted and cherry-picked, right? And you've just given some examples now. That is kind of a bit of a warning sign. But what do you make of the argument for bringing back species, not for ecological reasons, but for the purpose of raising awareness of species? I mean, you can imagine the amount of public interest in a mammoth in a zoo, for example. You know, everyone in the world would flock to see it, but perhaps only for a while. You know, it might only garner interest for a little while, but it could be potentially a really powerful in situ conservation tool. And I'm not necessarily ascribing to that argument, but what do you make of that?
So I actually am worried about that backfiring. What I'm sure will be a much hyped first mammoth. Imagine if the Bucardo had been the much hyped first species and the world was tuning in on television to watch the birth of the de-extincted Bucardo, and then it died choking 7 minutes later. That would be bad. So I think that as another example, there's this rewilding experiment in the Netherlands, basically bringing back, is intended to bring back ungulate grazing in an ecosystem where that was lacking. And the point of it was that once they put the animals out in the rewilding, they were not going to be maintained like livestock. They were going to, you know, live and die in that setting. And so they had a particularly cold winter, or I don't know, maybe a drought. I think it was cold winter. And a lot of animals died in full view of the public, and people went ape. I mean, they absolutely lost it. There was concern about animal rights. There was concern that the people running the project weren't, you know, maintaining well. Activists came and they threw hay over the fences to feed the animals. And it was a public relations nightmare. It was actually perfectly good illustration, if you want, of carrying capacity and, you know, growth of populations. It's what happens when you introduce any wild population to an area of fixed resources, right? It was perfectly expected that such a thing would happen, that in a bad year, the population would decline, but people couldn't take looking at it. So I think the same thing has the potential for happening with any of these resurrected species, that there's going to be a huge amount of ballyhoo about it. And then something's going to go badly wrong. They're going to die, or they're going to I don't know, maybe invade. But I'm not sure that the conservation value of it in terms of engaging the public with conservation is going to be a wild success at the beginning. I mean, maybe if you could engage the public around the issues of genetic rescue, like the black-footed ferret, like I think the black-footed ferret story is one that ought to be told more. I've rarely encountered anybody, you know, outside of conservation circles who's ever heard of it. So, you know, maybe arguing for like, well, this is the mammoth, but the reason we bought it back is, you know, because we've now got like all these extant species are being taken care of by the technology that we develop. You know, I guess the other thing that I worry about is in terms of public attention, if we get to the point of releasing a small population of de-extincted species, have we just created the world's most expensive poaching target? I was just talking the other day to this guy who works on Ted Turner's ranch where they have, they're preserving bighorn, but they partly do it through trophy hunting. And it costs a minimum of $75,000 to go out and hunt a bighorn sheep. And if you want a really big trophy animal, the price tag can get up to like $500,000. That's for a species that's still extant. And, you know, after the great auk went extinct, a trade came up in preserved auk eggs. All of the auk egg specimens that exist are known. They're of known provenance, and they're all with particular owners. And any time one comes up for sale, it goes to Sotheby's to be auctioned off, and they, you know, sell for like $100,000. Eggs of an extinct species. Can we protect the woolly mammoth from poaching? There's going to be somebody who will pay whatever it takes to get a mammoth head with those tusks on his wall. So that's maybe no different from, you know, the conservation issues we have around other endangered species and you know, endangered megafauna species. But to me, that's the flip side of what will be good about de-extinction is that the public will have a lot of attention to it. I almost think the public attention is going to be a negative.
Next time, I'll be joined again by Russell Gault, who was the guest on the May 2023 episode of the podcast on questioning environmental orthodoxy. This time, we'll be discussing capitalism and whether it's better or worse for the environment than the available alternatives. Russell is qualified in both ecology and conservation and business administration, so he has a lot of interesting thoughts on this topic. I hope you can join us.